Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Good morning. I'm Jean Marie Schaefer.
Hey, good morning. I'm Kim Hance.
And this is the Herzog Law Firm Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour, where we talk about and answer your questions about estate planning, elder law, Medicaid, probate, and related topics. It is a call-in show. Please feel free to call in and ask us a question at any time. Our number is 518-476-5900. So good morning, Kim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How was your Thanksgiving?
Oh, our Thanksgiving was great. This was the first year that we've had a good turkey.
Oh, really?
Usually, you know how turkeys all dried out and, you know, not so good.
Well, yeah.
Well, this year we bought our turkey from a local farm. So it was raised just about a few miles down the road. And I don't know if that made the difference, but it was really good.
Everybody has their own recipe for a turkey. I know sometimes it's hard. If you cook low and slow, it has a tendency to dry out.
Yeah.
If you do fast and then slow down and then baste a lot, I mean, you know, it's hard to do.
Right.
Yeah.
I used to do.
I actually think the local makes a difference because they're allowed to grow naturally, and I think it just, we've always done that in the past.
Absolutely.
Last couple, I mean, we've always grown our own for a long time, and then the last couple of years we haven't, and we've just bought local, but I do think it makes a difference, and I just think the flavor's better.
Yeah, I think the flavor is better, but talking about cooking low and slow, that reminds me of a funny thing.
Okay.
For you, that was kind of a newer way to cook turkeys, and for years when the kids were younger, that's the way I would do it. And my mother-in-law did not like that way, so I didn't know when I left the kitchen and was doing things. She always went in and turned up the heat because she thought it had to be higher.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, but remember the days when I'd have to start my turkey at 5 a.m.
Right.
No, you don't.
Yeah, you don't.
You don't. So. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, that's how it was for many years.
That's
And that gives a whole new term to passive-aggressive there, Jean Marie.
Yes, that's right.
Well, good. I'm glad everybody had a good Thanksgiving. The weather is beautiful.
Yeah, weather is nice. Very nice. Beautiful ride in. I love it when the Hudson looks kind of like a mirror. That's kind of beautiful weather.
Right. So what's going on? What's new in the neighborhood? Anything fun and exciting happen the past couple of weeks?
Let's see. Well, lots of new stuff going on, meeting with clients. A lot of clients are getting ready to head south for the winter, which I don't blame them.
Yeah.
And they're coming in and they want to get things finalized before they go south. And I understand. Not a problem. We can get that done for you. It kind of prompts some people to look over their stuff and, you know, make sure it's up to date.
Yeah, it's interesting. We sponsored one of the Alzheimer's Association's regional caregiver conferences, a week before last, and it was held at Hudson Valley Community College, and it was a great day, and we had a really great turnout of, you know, caregivers and family members that were just coming to get information and things like that. And so I sat on one of the informational panels, and I was really amazed. I've had like 4 or 5 phone calls of people who, you know, just through the panel discussions that we had, it really raised a lot of questions for them. And 4 of the 5 people that have reached out to me, you know, because we were talking about the importance of documents and, you know, to your point, like how you, even though you do them, you should take them out every so often, brush them off, kind of review them, make sure everything is the way it was supposed to be, right? The way you intended, because things change, right? And a diagnosis of Alzheimer's certainly changes people's circumstances. And so 4 of these 5 each had their significant other as their primary healthcare proxy and power of attorney. And we brought that up as being a challenge because that's not a person that you necessarily want to make decisions for you. And really the capacity is going to be such that they're not going to be able to make those decisions for you once, you know, the disease advances a little bit. And so It's why it's so super important. And I know we have people come in from time to time that, you know, maybe an account is different or a beneficiary has passed away or there's been a divorce. You know, so it's so important, like what you just said, you know, people coming in and scheduling those appointments. And don't wait for an event, I guess, is what I'm trying to say is, you know, don't wait to be a snowbird. Don't wait for something bad to happen. You know, it's something that, that folks can come in at any point and just talk about and review and make sure it still aligns with what their goals are.
Right, that's true. And as to the spouse who's losing capacity, I mean, that's so important. It's a tough conversation because they don't always want to take off their spouse, right?
Right.
And but I guess it's admitting that, you know, they can't do anything anymore that would help them. So, but it's really important to try and get another family member in their place, or at the very least as a backup, so that someone else could help you out and you're not relying on the spouse with the disease.
Right. And we also had a very interesting conversation, you know, about the difference between legal competence and capacity, right? Because there's a difference in that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, there is a difference. Well, for example, just getting a diagnosis of Alzheimer's doesn't mean that you can't sign documents, right? You may be very early on in the stages, even kind of up to mid-stage, you could still sign documents. And it's really, you're going to, you know, we as lawyers and our paralegals, we're going to sit down with that person. And they just have to know, you know, what they, who their family members are, what their assets are, who they want to get those assets. I mean, that's kind of for a will or for a power of attorney. They need to know, okay, this is my daughter and I want my daughter to handle things for me. It's
right.
Really, and you can have moments of clarity or days, you know, that are better than others. And it's not necessarily a memory thing, right? Alzheimer's, you know, you're losing memory, but you may not lose the capacity to sign a legal document because in the moment you may understand completely what you're doing. And that's, you know, all we need to know is that you understand it at that moment.
Right, right. And that was definitely a very enlightening conversation, I think, for a lot of people that we have, because, you know, really one of the things that we said is competency really is it's a global assessment. It's looking at everything, right? Because somebody might not be able to make financial decisions, but they can still make their own medical decisions, right? They you know, they might not have the ability to keep their finances straight. They may need some help with that, but they still have clear, you know, acute awareness of sort of what they want their medical decisions to be those sorts of things. And so, you know, really when we talk about competency, we're looking at all angles of an individual's ability to manage things. And that's really kind of, it's determined by a judge, you know, whether or not somebody is competent. So whether or not we'd have to do a guardianship for somebody if those things were questionable. You know, and then to your point, capacity really is, you know, just that sort of assessment on a particular area. So, and it really doesn't have to be performed by a medical professional. You know, to your point, it's something if we feel somebody is sitting in our office and they're very aware and, you know, able to articulate what their wishes are, we can certainly, you know, help them. So that was a big thing, particularly when you're at a conference for folks that are dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia. You want people to understand, like, even though you have a diagnosis, it doesn't mean that it's too late.
Right, that's right. You still should go see a lawyer, get your documents done. You know, if for example, a child brings their parent in and, you know, it's obvious to us that they can't sign something, of course, we're going to have to recommend a different route. But it's always helpful to meet with us and just let us assess and see if they can sign documents. You know, a power of attorney and a healthcare proxy is so much easier than the alternative, which is a guardianship, which is why we recommend that you do this early on, right? I mean, before you have a diagnosis or, you know.
Sure.
At retirement age is usually the best time to do this before that or other illnesses could develop. You know, the time
right.
to do it is when there is no crisis going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's much easier for families to be able to follow a guideline and really understand, you know, when that's done. And we say all the time, I think the biggest fear, particularly as people age, is losing in the independence, right? Losing the independence to be able to make those decisions for themselves and having to rely on others and really having these things taken care of well ahead of time is certainly one of the best ways to maintain control and really be the driver of your ship for as long as possible.
That's right. And, you know, you can put in different alternates. You can put in, you know, if you have a couple children or other family members, you can, you know, make sure you have backups, and that's always really important. I kind of hate it when someone comes in and I look at their old documents and they only appointed one person. I'm like, well, that's not very helpful, right?
Right.
Or they're coming in because that one person is gone, right? So now we have to do all new documents. I've seen people do as many as 3 or 4 backups, and that may be excessive, but you should at least have 1 or 2 backups in there.
Sure. And one of the other things that we talked about that really helps with that, too, is, you know, you have the documents that you fill out with us, healthcare, proxy, living will, those types of things, but another really beneficial document to do, and this is something you actually do with your physician, it's called a MOLST, you know, so an M-O-L-S-T, and I know we've talked about it, you know, from time to time on the show, but it's a document that's sort of forgotten sometimes. And the reason I love a MOLST so much is it's a medical order, right? So it follows you. It goes in your medical record. The thing about just having a healthcare proxy is sometimes if that healthcare proxy hasn't been uploaded into your portal or you're visiting, you know, a physician that's not connected, sometimes it's hard to sort of remember to carry that healthcare proxy with you wherever you go. Whereas a MOLST, because it becomes part of your medical record, it's just there for all to see. And that's really beneficial because a lot of times people end up in a situation where they, you know, end up hospitalized. You know, there's an event, they end up hospitalized, and really the hospital isn't aware of what an individual's wishes are. They can't get in touch with next of kin, or they don't know who the healthcare proxies are. So, you know, they go about doing everything they can to treat whatever is happening at the moment. And it's so hard for families then to sort of have to intervene when maybe the prognosis isn't so great. If initially upon presentation at the hospital, it was known sort of what that individual's wishes are. So a MOLST is another really great planning document, I think, that we encourage our clients to have. And that could be anyone who's aging and has chronic illnesses that would require any kind of long-term treatment. And at some point, you know, you may decide that I'm kind of done. I really want to focus on the quality of my life and not so much all of these medications and things that I have to take to keep me going. So,
right. It's making sure that you get to pick, you know, what type of medical treatment you have. And it's, you know, all of our planning is about, you know, choices and making sure you do this so you have the choice to pick what you want and you're not leaving it up to someone else to make that decision for you who may not really make the best decision or may not match what you want to have done.
Right.
So I'm just going to give out our number again. You can call in. It's 518-476-5900. We'd be happy to take your calls. And kind of to continue on this discussion, Kim, since we have you here, there is an article that I read about you know, what to do after a client has a fall. And, you know, that's a really common thing that happens to elderly individuals. In fact, I was surprised to read that in this article that 1 out of every 4 Americans age 65 and older falls each year. Now, that's a lot. I mean, not every fall is going to result in a hospitalization, but it can. You know, we see it all the time. You know, typical is falling and having a hip fracture.
And did you know that if someone with dementia takes a nasty fall, that can increase the dementia problem?
That's right. It can.
Yeah.
Right. So it's really going to lead to, you know, some consequences.
Yeah.
And there's lots of things that we can do as elder law attorneys to help you prepare for that. Or with Kim, you know, also as a aging life care manager. I'm sorry, I just don't like that term, but
I hear you.
We're not aging, right? We're holding strong, but
there you go.
But this is a time where we often get calls from family members, and Kim can be very helpful. We can be very helpful. And one of the first thing this article talks about is common causes for falls. And
Right. It
could be, as I said, anything from the, hip fracture. It could be muscle weakness. It could be impaired vision. So it's important to make sure that seniors are taking care of their health and making sure some of these issues, if they can be avoided, that they could be avoided.
Right.
Certain preventative things that they can do.
Well, to your point, there's so many things that can sort of precipitate a fall, right? And it can be medication, how medications interact with one another. So many diagnoses also. I mean, I think, you talked about impaired vision, but even like hearing can offset balance, just general weakness, diabetes, heart disease, particularly Parkinson's disease is a really big one because, we have issues with muscle rigidity and freezing up, and that is really a huge risk for falls. There's almost every chronic diagnosis that we deal with as we age can be a factor to, someone having a fall. And we see so often, particularly when we've got two individuals living together and we have, one spouse caring for the other, that, most falls happen in the bathroom. And really a lot of those can be prevented with just simple handrails or a nice shower chair or putting an extended handheld shower in the shower so the individual doesn't have to stand up and lose their balance, Because the other thing we know is when you've got a caregiver helping an individual and you've got two aging people who aren't at the prime of their physical health, when one person goes down, more than likely they're going to take the second person down with them. And then we've got two people who are in trouble. So we really want to talk safety, and we really, because there are a lot of things that we can do that don't even require care per se. So many tools that we can put into the home to really help maintain that independence and just make for a safer environment. We can get physical therapy and occupational therapy involved, and really occupational therapy is really focused on all of the different kinds of adaptive equipment that can be used in the home to make things just safe enough that somebody can be fully independent. It could even be putting in an electronic monitoring system, like, one of my favorite things is the help I've fallen and I can't get up button. Mm-hmm. And because it just can help alleviate a lot of stress that people feel and anxiety. But, so often people are going up and down stairs, and what happens if you fall and you don't have your cell phone on you? I mean, I know, for example, for me, I'm in my pajamas at the moment because I'm calling from home, but, my pajamas don't have pockets. So if I get up and get a cup of coffee, I'm not taking my cell phone with me. And what happens if I trip and fall and hit my head? I'm not going to be able to push a button and call for help. So a lot of these personal emergency response systems come equipped with a fall detector. They come equipped with GPS locators if we have somebody who might be a wander risk. So there's lots of technology out there that can be used that doesn't really require even an individual coming in and sort of, I think that's a scary thing, having somebody you don't know kind of come into the house to do things. But there are a lot of things that we can implement in a home to really help enhance independence and keep people safe.
Right. I mean, I know that's one of your roles when you go out to make a home visit is to look around the house. And as I've heard you talk about before, there's some really easy things you can do, like the area rugs to pick those up, find things that you have on the floor that you could trip on. Or, sometimes people have things on their stairs that they just shouldn't have there, like you're leaving things there. That you could trip over, right? You need to remove those and get them out of the way. So Even, you know, short steps in and out of the house, you could easily fix that with a ramp.
A chair leg. Watch where you put the chairs.
Yes, that's right.
Because it happened to me a couple of weeks ago. I just turned around and caught my foot on a chair leg, and it was like, ah.
See, you could have.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Right. I mean, we all are just a short fall.
Sure.
Away from something happening.
Right.
You know, and not just in the house. I mean, going outside of the house in the wintertime, right? If you don't have an attached garage and you're walking outside to get to your car, you know, you need to make sure it's...
It can be a battle zone.
It can be, that's right.
These early mornings now are, you can take your life on your own hands because, you know, we've had a little bit of precipitation and,
right.
You know, I laugh because my husband and I have all of these conversations, like, we're the worst aging candidates right now because we have so many hazards. Like, we have natural stone stairs that lead up to our house. Well, they freeze very quickly, and you can't see that there's a sheet of ice. The number of times that, you know, all of us, including our teenage daughter, have taken a fall on the steps because we're not even cued into that there might be ice on them, right?
I know. I've done that also, sure. And,
you know,
okay, and now we have a caller. So we have Nick from Albany. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. I had a question for Kim. I think she could help me with this.
Sure.
My dad is in a assisted living. He's been there for a while, and he's a veteran. And we're in the spend-down mode. Done all the paperwork as far as trusts. He has a family trust. He has his power of attorney in place. We have the healthcare proxy. And my question was, do the things like his home and his, annuities and things like that have to be spent down that are in the trust in order to meet the limit? And what is the limit for aid and assistance program that is out there for combat veterans?
So, Jim Ram, I'll let you take
this
part of the question, and then I'm going to talk about the aid and attendance benefit, if that works.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. So, if you have things in a trust and they're an irrevocable trust, they protect those assets just like they do for Medicaid. So, it just has to be in there long enough. It's interesting. For the veterans' benefits, they didn't have a look back for years, but then they put in a 3-year look back period. So, similar to the Medicaid look back period. So if you've had your trust around for more than 3 years, you don't have to worry about what's in the trust. You don't have to spend that down. You're really just looking at the assets outside of the trust to make sure they're spent down. And I don't have the exact figure. I think it's around 90 to 100,000. I could confirm that for you if you want to call during the week. But that's what I think. That's around the asset level you'd have to be eligible. And then in terms of the expense, you have to show that your long-term care expenses exceed your income. So, for example, if you're going into an assisted living facility, you would have to show that the cost of the facility exceeds your monthly income. And if it does, then you can get a benefit to help you.
Would it be in the amount that the difference is from what you take in from a pension and Social Security compared to the amount that is a monthly fee? Would it be just that amount that you'd be entitled to?
No, it's a fixed amount. So, again, it's a stipend every month, and I'm just giving you a rough estimate here. It could be around $1,500, maybe a little bit higher. It's somewhere in that range. So if that's enough to cover the gap, yes, that helps you. But if you still have a gap, you know, that's the top limit that the veterans will give you.
So if I could just go over this. So he has had his trust in place and the documents for less than a year. Mm. So they recommended keeping just enough to cover like a year's expenses out. Mm-hmm. And then you'd be able to go after dividends or whatever. So if his trust is in place for 3 years, then the monies that are outside, and it's going to be well below $90,000, then you'd be able to make an application for the aid and attendance benefit in order to supplement his his fee for the, mm-hmm. the assisted living.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Okay, right. Great. Thank you very much for that information. 3 years. I'll mark. I'll get a couple calendars
going out
and mark them. Mark the days so I let him know, because he's very concerned. Every month we go over his financials.
Yes,
and
yes.
He sees that it goes down. You know, 1,000, 1,500, 1,700, because everything's getting raised. The raises
don't
come
up.
In from the from the facilities on a regular basis. I appreciate the information. Thank you very much, and happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, sure. Happy Thanksgiving.
Bye.
And that was kind of just the financial piece of it. And, Kim, if you want to talk a little bit about, you know, the other requirements for the aid in attendance benefit.
Right. So generally they're looking for somebody who needs assistance with three or more activities of daily living. So, you know, things like bathing, dressing, toileting, continence care, transferring, ambulating. And generally when you're in an assisted living, they're providing those types of services for you. So it's sort of an automatic qualification, if you will. I think the other thing to consider for some people in particular, because we have a growing Vietnam population aging into the system now, and in addition to the aid in attendance, there's also a compensation program that some of our Vietnam veterans would be eligible for based on diagnoses they have because of exposure to Agent Orange. And this is becoming a more known benefit, but it's still not, a lot of people don't really know about it. And there are a lot of different diagnoses that are considered to have been exposure and really to be eligible for that compensation. And the compensation is different than a pension, right? So the pension is really, you qualify from a financial standpoint, you qualify from a need standpoint as far as your activities of the daily living. The compensation is due to a factor of exposure. You have to be service-connected. You have to have a service-connected disability. You have to have a certain percentage of disability. But again, the diagnoses that are tied to that compensation are pretty popular. Neuropathy, sclerotic heart disease, diabetes. There are a lot of different diagnoses that our folks, as they age, that may have served, would be eligible for that compensation benefit. And I always, when I'm meeting with a family, you know, one of the first questions I ask is, you know, are you a veteran? And a lot of our veterans, particularly the time of the Korean-Vietnam War, they never really accessed their VA benefit. Not too late to do that. Really encourage.
So that's a really great thing to, yeah, make sure that you ask your clients when you're meeting with them. All right, and now we're up for our break, and we'll be right back with the Herzog Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back. I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
Hi, good morning. I'm Kim Hance.
And this is the second half of the, Herzog Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour, where we answer your questions about wills and trusts and Medicaid and guardianships and all types of related things. This is a call-in show. You can give us a call at 518-476-5900, and we can answer your questions. So we had a really good first half. We had a great call about veterans benefits. So I just want to remind everyone that that's something you should think about when you're thinking about your options for long-term care. If you're a veteran or not, you should look into those benefits. So going back, where we were kind of overall looking at the scenario where someone is in their home and they fall. Because as we all know, that's a precursor to a stay in a rehab facility or a nursing home. But first, before you go there, you go to the hospital. And there's a lot of things that can happen in the hospital that you may need assistance with, right? Generally, it's going to be your discharge planning. Because they don't want to keep you in there very long. They kind of want to get you fixed and push you out. And I know that's a lot of times where we get a phone call from the family because they do feel pressure. And that's where oftentimes Kim is really a good help to these families to help them know what their discharge options are.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it is hard because, you know, it's sort of the combination. And unfortunately, the hospital just can't do the jobs that they were performed to do because it's really the insurances now that are driving, the qualifying stays, if you will. And most cases, I mean, generally, if you've got somebody who is in overnight or more than a day, we want to make sure that we understand what their status is and if they're receiving medical treatment for any particular thing, that it's being documented and we're aware of. The biggest push is what happens is you present, they treat you medically for whatever's going on, and now there's no medical reason for you to be at the hospital. Now, there's a big difference between the medical need and, well, my mom is no longer going to be able to climb stairs because of this, and those types of things. So we kind of have to distinguish the difference between what the need is and what the issue is, right? And so that's where the hospital is really looking at what they can do. To your point, we do get a lot of calls because a lot of times the return home is not the best thing or, you know, in the best interest of the individual. So we might advocate for a rehab stay. And prior to the pandemic, there was like sort of a hard, fast rule out there that you needed to have a 3-day hospitalization in order to qualify for rehab. That is no longer the case. The pandemic really allowed for more flexibility in sort of rehab laws. It's really up to the insurance company or Medicare company to say whether or not a rehab stay is justified. And for a lot of families, we don't want long-term care placement, right? Nobody wants to go to a nursing home. But getting some short-term services from a rehab facility, which is generally a nursing home, is really beneficial. Like, it can really help build some of, you know, if somebody was weak or somebody was having, just needs some strength management and learning how to do things safely, maybe using a walker, maybe using a cane, maybe, you know, having some adaptive equipment introduced to them and learning and coaching on how to use that. A rehab stay can be really beneficial, and it gives the family time to do some more planning, right? When you come into the hospital and then you're bounced right back out to home, what usually happens?
You usually go back.
Right. We have another event that causes the person to go back, and usually that repeat event is more serious than the first go-around.
Mm-hmm.
Really want to kind of coach families on, you know, even if there was a minor fall and it requires going to the hospital or even urgent care to be checked out, that's when you really need to start investigating what all of the options are, because we know that that's going to sort of start that curve of needing some more services, right?
That's right. And often when they call, you know, it's the discharge planning that they need help with. I'm losing my voice. Sorry. So when you get that call, right, maybe the family hasn't thought about this, so they need time to evaluate whether they can bring someone home and get help at home, or whether they need to go to assisted living. And you don't really have time to figure that all out in 24 hours, which is often the times. And then you know, you're getting the pressure from the hospital that, well, if you don't leave, we're going to charge you full price for the bed in the hospital, which is a fortune. So it's hard to figure all that out and get the right place. You know, even if you, okay, we're going to go to a rehab facility, you may not like the one that they chose for you. And you want chance to, you know, see others. And they give you that chance, you know, you have to give us five, right? And if none of those five are available, then we're going to send you to the closest one that's has a bed available. And a lot of people come to, and it's, you know, the one that they're given is either really far away or it doesn't have a good rating. So it's hard to figure all this out. I mean, you have to be a really good advocate for your family member. And sometimes, you know, you need some help and coaching doing that, and then Kim can help you doing that. I mean, we're not saying that she can find you the perfect bed somewhere. We don't have that power. but she can give you...
But sometimes we do, and I will say that
we do.
More often than not, you know, having somebody... Because generally what happens is at a hospital is they just fill out paperwork and they just randomly fax it, right? So and nursing homes, rehab centers get hundreds of faxes of people a day, right? So forming connections, and that's one of the things that I do, you know, I've made it a point to be in the community and learn who the providers are, and form relationships with those people. Because a lot of times when I make a call and say, hey, look, I've got a family who's in a bind, this is what we're our plan is, and a lot of times families have started the planning process with us, right? And maybe something happens, and so, you know, I'll say to the social worker at the nursing home or the admissions planner is like, you know, our goal is to bring this person home. This is sort of what the you know what we're thinking, but we need a rehab stay or we need a short term stay, maybe, you know, to your point, in an assisted living to be able to keep this person safe and sort of at status quo until we can get that in place. You know, we've utilized assisted livings for a short-term stay while we're doing community Medicaid planning because, you know, the individual's not really safe at home. And as we know, care is hard to find. So we get creative on how we can help families. But particularly when that hospitalization happens, it really throws folks for a loop because... it puts us sort of in the crisis mode.
Because a home care discharge, you can't just plan that quickly, right? I mean, you have to find, you know, people, right? And you have to fit up the house, right? Sometimes you need to do some renovations to make sure the bathroom's, you know, accessible or move the bed down to the first floor. And all these things can be done, but you need some time to do that, you know? And you're not going to be able to stay in the hospital while they're doing that, right? So... And, you know, you have to look at other options. You know, sometimes going to rehab, I mean, you may need the rehab before you could get home. And sometimes we don't know. So, you know, when we meet with or we get a call from clients, we don't really know for sure whether they're going to be home or go into a nursing home. So we're kind of planning for both options until they've been in rehab a little bit longer and then we know exactly where they're going to go. But we have that flexibility to kind of... you know, pivot either way and look at, you know, their options for financially, right?
Right. And we're also going to encourage, you know, I just was working with a family recently and, you know, one of the things that I really encourage, I mean, so first thing we generally always say is you can file appeal if you really feel like there's a medical reason for your loved one to be there. Now, again, we're talking about medical reason and not just that, well, she can't be home because it's not safe sort of thing, right? That's we really have to educate on the medical need versus, you know, even with somebody with advancing dementia, it's like, I can't take care of them at home anymore. That's not really a medical need, right? So we really have to distinguish the difference. So, you know, we really do see that there's a medical need for somebody to be there, you know, we can file a Medicare appeal. We can look at really advocating if the person is not stable. You know, a lot of times blood pressure can be erratic. You know, there's just sort of that general failure to thrive, and we're not sure what's going on. So if there are other medical things that this individual needs. Now, remember, we have to go back to the advanced directive planning that we did with this individual, and do they want aggressive treatment? So that's another thing you kind of have to answer yourself, because, you know, if somebody's in the hospital and, you know, aging is just the normal aging process is happening, and perhaps an individual is like, I don't want a lot of heroic message, you know, measures. I don't want a lot of, I don't want to be poked and prodded and stuck in a tube and those kinds of things. So, you know, again, we're looking at managing a chronic, you know, illness. And so what are some things that we can do to keep this person more comfortable? A lot of times it's reaching out to your loved ones, Medicare company, you know, whatever a lot of folks have, you know, Advantage plans now or managed benefits. So it's calling CDPHP, MVP. Everybody has an assigned case manager to their benefit. And it's talking to that individual and like, what benefits are available under my Medicare plan? A lot of Medicare plans, you know, don't have a 3-day requirement anymore for rehab, but going beyond that, a lot of them also now have a built-in benefit of, you know, 25 hours a week of home care. Now, we always talk and say Medicare isn't long-term care. It's not. It's related to health. It's your health insurance. But more and more plans are putting in this sort of 25, you know, hour benefit where they'll send a personal care assistant in to help with showers, to help with medication reminders, because what they're seeing, right, is if they can do some preventative work. Remember, we talked earlier in the show that one of the worst places or one of the top places that people fall is in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So if they can have a personal care assistant come in and help with the shower, maybe even just be there for supervision, right, we're avoiding a much bigger problem down the line. So there's kind of coming on to a lot more of these preventative services that will really help maintain somebody's independence for a much longer time. So that's why I say, you know, particularly now, we're in the middle of open enrollment. So it's really super important for you to understand your Medicare benefit, understand what it offers, and maybe find something that might offer you a little bit more than what you already have that can help with some of these things. And because ultimately, at the end of the day, should an emergency or crisis like this happen, the more options you have available to you, the better. So those are some really important things to sort of understand and be educated about.
Right, that's true. I mean, sometimes you don't know the benefits you have, right? You need to look at your policy, see what you have. I mean, it's like reading Greek or whatever.
Right.
It's hard to read that. And sometimes you need your children to help you read through that or make the phone calls for you.
Sure.
But this kind of goes back to, again, I know we keep hitting on this, the power of attorney and the healthcare proxy. So if you're in the hospital and your children need to call your health insurance company, they need the authority to be able to speak to them and get the information. So it's so important to have those documents that they can use to get this information for you.
Right, and to also be able to translate that and fill out the application for the nursing home, because even with rehab, even though it's deemed a short-term stay, most rehabs, since they are nursing homes, they want to know what the situation is beyond that rehab stay, right? Because even it, you know, even though days 1 through 20 are covered at 100%, at day 21, if you're still eligible for Medicare benefits, there's a copay, and the copay is not cheap. You know, it's $194.50 a day, and that comes out of your pocket.
Right.
That
adds up.
Very quickly, we can run up a pretty substantial bill, you know, with that copay. So even if you were to stay, you know, an extra 2 weeks in rehab, you know, that's up to $2,700 that you're going to be responsible for because of that copay. So we really want to understand what those financial repercussions are, and we want to be able to advocate as much as possible for, you know, somebody's ability. So a financial application is usually generally required. That's something we help a lot of families with, is help them with that universal application, particularly if a family has done trust, because the nursing home wants to see the trust. They want to see what language is there. You know, we can also help with placement. That's a lot of what I do. You know, just talking earlier, is I have a lot of relationships with the local nursing homes, and it's just putting in a call and saying, hey, look at this paperwork that you were sent. This is sort of the circumstances and situation with this family. It's sort of humanizing the referral.
That's right.
When it comes from the hospital, it's just what they see on paper. They don't see anything else. You know, and say that we are working with this family. This isn't a family that's going to get stuck. This isn't a family that's going to be, you know, or we might have the conversation and say, this is a family that might turn into a long-term care placement. We're not sure.
And, you know, when we're working with the facility, it's helpful for them to know that that there's an elder law attorney involved, so that if we're applying for Medicaid, they feel more secure that that application is going to get approved, rather than if the patient or, you know, is applying on their own because they haven't met with an elder law attorney. They don't know all the, you know, rules. They may have made transfers and gifts to their kids that's going to penalize them. And, you know, these days, the long-term care facilities, you know, I remember they used to be more lax about admitting individuals, and they used to call it Medicaid pending, right? Which meant they would wait. They knew they were applying for Medicaid, but they would admit them and then wait and see if they got approved. Now they really want to see that either you're approved or you have the money, right? They want a clear payment source before you get in. So, and you can't just apply for Medicaid before you're in the nursing home, right? You have to apply when you're in the facility. So it's a kind of hard timing, balancing act to get this all done and get you in and then get you approved. I mean, sometimes we have, clients who, you know, may qualify for Medicaid, but they have some money to pay privately for, you know, 2-3 months. So we do that sometimes. That's a, you know, way to spend down their outside money and get them into a facility. And that gives us time to get the Medicaid application in and approved. We still have time for a call. If you want to give us a call, it's 518-476-5900. Another time we, you know, get calls from clients is signing the admission agreement. And, you know, one thing I know that they're concerned about is, am I going to be responsible for my parents' bill at the nursing home?
Right.
And that's pretty common. And, you know, when you look at the admission agreement, what you want to look for is, if you're signing for your parent, you don't want to guarantee their payment, right? You're only signing as their power of attorney. And so that means you're only signing and signing up to use their assets to pay for the nursing home, not your own assets. Or you're also agreeing, that's in the admission agreement, that you will use your best efforts to apply for Medicaid, you know, so that you are doing, you're not doing anything to, you know, delay the application. You're going to go ahead with the application, get all of your parents' information to the best you can, and submit that to Medicaid to get approval. So you do have to look at those applications carefully. I mean, it's not as common that they can go after the children, but there have been lawsuits where they do try. So you really want to speak to an attorney, and we do review those applications for you. I've seen cases where they go after the children for what they call fraudulent transfers. That's one theory they try and use. You know, that maybe, you know, legitimately the parent made some gifts to the children a couple of years ago, and that disqualifies them for Medicaid. So now the nursing home's going to sue the children and try and get those gifts back. So I'm not saying that these theories always succeed in court, but there's, you know, been many attempts and ways to, you know, try and go after other family members to get the money. So, you know, that's why it is important to talk to an elder law attorney, make sure we're looking at the application, making sure we're having you sign, you know, in the right places and not over-promising or over-guaranteeing something that you don't need to do.
Right. And I mean, I think that's the biggest thing, too. We see so often with families who find themselves in a situation where, you know, they were told one thing and they're even told this by professionals, right? I mean, you and I, Jay Marie, have had a couple of clients come into the office that were, you know, and not out of malice, right? I mean, I don't think anybody is intentionally trying to steer somebody wrong, but they hear a bit of information and they don't really hear all of the follow-up to it. And, you know, what I say to families all the time is that, you know, we have a particular niche that we provide. And one of the things, and not all elder law attorneys are created equal. You know, there are lots of attorneys who can do estate planning, and estate planning really is your advanced directives and maybe, you know, your will, a trust, something like that. But when we talk about elder law, we're really talking about all of the different things that are encompassed. It's not just nursing home Medicaid. I mean, when we talk to folks, most people are aware of the five-year look back. You know, right now we live in a time where community Medicaid as well is a huge tool and resource that we use for, you know, our clients. And it's not just for home care. It's for transportation, and it's for adult day programs, and it's for, you know, maybe assistive technology or some modifications to the home. There are lots of things that are encompassed within community Medicaid. You know, as part of being an aging life care manager, I belong to a listserv that is open to all New York State aging life, you know, geriatric care managers. And, you know, people will pose questions from time to time. And, you know, we just had a whole big conversation about how the long-term care environment is shifting and how managed long-term care companies, which is a tool we use through community Medicaid, are really cutting hours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the care managers posed, I have a client with dementia, and they only awarded 4 hours a day. And I sort of had to remind, I was like, hey, you know, managed long-term care companies are really looking at things from somebody's personal hands-on care needs basis. They're not looking at the cognitive status of an individual. So there's another program out there that you could utilize, you know, the NHTD waiver. And it sparked this whole conversation about how people are like, oh, I completely forgot that that was an option. And so that's why it's really important to be working with somebody who understands the needs of an aging population. It's not just about, yes, healthcare proxy, yes, will, yes, you know, power of attorney. It's really working with somebody that understands what happens as somebody ages. So when you have, you know, an unexpected event happen, which is so often the case with folks that we work with, you've got a trusted partner in your plan, you know, in helping you create sort of what you want for yourself.
Yeah, there's a lot more that goes into it. And, you know, as you said, some attorneys do the wills and simple wills and healthcare proxies and powers of attorney. And I've had some of them, you know, when the client needs a nursing home, say, oh, you need to go, you know, to an elder law attorney, or they refer to us or someone else, you know, because they know that's kind of beyond what they can do. They can kind of just do your simple will. And that's fine. And we want you to get your healthcare proxy and power of attorney done, you know, wherever you can get it done. If it is the attorney, you know, in your town that can do that for you, that's great. But as your needs progress and as you get older, you do want to sit down and talk to an elder law attorney, so you do understand everything else that's going on. You know, and that's where we can help you. And we're going to give you options, right? You know, we're going to put all the options on the table so you can really make a decision as to how you want to receive your care. Kind of goes back to basics, you know, when we're meeting someone, you know, not in the crisis mode, right? But when they're well, we're doing their plan. Let's think ahead. Where do you want to live as you age, right? These are some of the basic questions. Who's going to take care of you? How are you going to pay for it? And it kind of just goes back to those basics and thinking about that as to where you want to get your care, and then we can move forward and have a plan to get you towards that result. You know, if you want to be at home, then this is what we need to do to get you there. Right.
Right. No, it's so important to really understand all of the options that are out there, and, you know, particularly having access to a care manager that sort of, you know, I always joke and say I like to color outside the lines, right? I'm always looking for all of the other options that are available and what are some of the other resources that we can pull in to help, you know, help enhance somebody or really help sustain them for a much longer period of time. So those, you know, I really just encourage people to use us for that, right, for that expert opinion and advice on what is out there.
Yeah, it's changing. There's more options available as our population is aging. I mean, I think I've seen the number of assisted living facilities just grow in the capital region over the past, you know, 10 to 15 years. There's new facilities. And, you know, we kind of try and keep up to date on all of them and new options that are available. You know, it's not all the same model. There's some models that are kind of like a campus, right, where you go from a house to an assisted living to a nursing home. That's one option you can do. There's the option of, you know, like the Yeti Village Green, which is small houses that you live in, not a big facility. So, you know, it is interesting to see some of the developments that have come along to fit people's different needs.
Right. And it's also exploring all the other options and alternatives that are out there, because a big conversation I have with clients is like, what are your goals for aging? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you see this go? And, you know, I grew up hearing that, you know, once you retire and you start to, this is your golden years. And, mm-hmm. and really that's our focus. Mm-hmm. And I say so often, so many times we're meeting with people and it's not very golden. Mm-hmm. and it's really helping them advocate for, mm-hmm. for their wishes and for what they want. And, you know, we navigate and negotiate a lot of times with family members too, right? Because we have family members that call and say, my parents are not making great choices. And sometimes we're there to say, okay, right. So what can we do to help? And sometimes we're here to say to the kids, well, they're not living your life, but they're living their life, and that's okay right now, you know?
Yeah, sometimes you have to let them make those bad choices, which is kind of, as parents of 20-year-olds, we know that from the parenting side. Sometimes
right?
you have to twist that around and say, okay, my parents are not making a great choice, or not the choice I would make right now, but this is what they want to do. And,
right.
you know, we just have to... accommodate that and make sure that they're safe and they have options going, you know, but not treat them like children, right? They can make their own choices.
Well, I think that's a big part of it. And, you know, we want to make sure that everybody's as educated as they possibly can and really to be able to focus on a good quality, you know, a good quality of life for folks.
That's right. Well, thank you for listening and have a wonderful weekend.
Great. Have a great weekend.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.